Well, welcome to our latest episode of the Guardians of the Flame podcast. It's a real privilege today to be interviewing Sean Farron, who is has had different roles over the years. He's been a member of the SDLP, which is, for those watching not from Northern Ireland, the SDLP would have been, during the Troubles, would have been the largest nationalist political party, and the leader of which was John Hume, who received a Nobel Peace Prize. He passed away earlier this year. And Sean Farron's written, been involved in two books about John Hume. And so we kind of want to have this interview where we explore, Sean, your own life, the life of John Hume, and kind of ask questions maybe on a bigger scale about what do we do in contexts where there's political conflict and conflict of all kinds, and the role that political leaders can play in shaping transformative policies and peacemaking and dialogue. And so thank you, Sean, for letting us invade your house and come in and spend a few minutes and talking about some of these issues. Could you just kind of just give us a brief sketch of your background, kind of the last year, all the you've been doing everything from teaching in Sierra Leone to political office here to teaching in university?
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing about me, I suppose, that might strike people who would know accents, where they come from here in Ireland. I'm not from the north. I'm a dub by birth and by schooling. I spent the first 20 years of my life in Dublin until I left and left to work in Sierra Leone. And it was several years after that, when I had come back from a first tour of 3 years in Sierra Leone, met my future wife, got married, and we decided to spend the first 2 years of our married life in Sierra Leone. And it was after that, when I came home, that I moved to the north to take up a one-year temporary lectureship at the University of Ulster, the new university as it was called then. And I little expected to be there more than that 1 year, but at the end of the year, the post, I was offered a permanent post there, and so began to put down roots. We had two of our four children by that stage, and we, as I say, began to put down our roots. Two more children were born. We have three girls and a boy, of course, all grown up and have their own families now. And gradually became, I suppose, a member of the local community, got to know people. And in particular, the people who were members of the SDLP who encouraged me to join. Why did I join the SDLP? Well, I suppose, simply put, at that time, around the early 1970s, Northern Ireland was exploding onto the world scene, as it were. Exploding in the sense that there was violence was breaking out, and terrible things were happening. And having a general interest in politics myself, I began to learn more about local political leaders, and in particular, those leaders who formed the SDLP, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, which grew out of the Northern Ireland civil rights movement a few years earlier in the mid to late 60s. And amongst the leaders were people like John Hume, Austin Curry, Paddy Devlin, and so on. And I suppose it was the articulative nature of these leaders that attracted my attention. John Hume, Austin Curry, and their colleagues seemed to speak sense in a simple word. They seemed to offer, to me anyway, that the best possible way forward, a way forward through partnership and through consent to constitutional change. In other words, if people in Northern Ireland wanted to change the constitutional status of the region, it had to be done democratically, not through violence, not through the violence of the IRA, which was only alienating those whom they hoped to inveigle into a united Ireland. And it was, as I say, because of people like Hume and Curry, Paddy Devlin, Gerry Fitt, who were offering the way forward through a partnership between the two communities in the north, a partnership between north and south, focusing on social and economic development. That was the way forward, and that's what attracted me into the SDLP and gradually to become increasingly involved in the politics of the SDLP and play some small part at that time in the development of the SDLP's policies.
Mm. So on our drive up here this afternoon, we were listening to a song written by our neighbour who we've actually interviewed for this podcast before, Tommy Sands. And it's a song he wrote about John Hume called "The A Quiet Man," the ballad for John Hume, which is it's actually a beautiful song. And in it is this line kind of ascribed to John, "Don't die for Ireland, live for it instead." So John Hume seems to have been someone who kind of emerged out of from Derry, Londonderry, the time of Bloody Sunday and the civil rights marches, and he emerged out of that with and it seems to be a real passionate belief in the importance of dialogue and peacemaking, where some people believed in we need to pick up weapons. What was it that made John Hume make that kind of take that path, if you like?
Well, I suppose when you look back on it and try to analyse John's approach to conflict resolution, his message was a very simple one. It was the message of partnership, of working together, of spilling our sweat together and not our blood. He was challenging a number of traditional approaches to the problem of community relations in Northern Ireland and community relations between North and South. The traditional nationalist view was that the partition of Ireland was a wrong. It had been imposed by the British, and the only way to undo it and to move to a united Ireland was by force of arms. And John challenged that position very, very clearly and trenchantly. He said, essentially, if we take an eye for an eye, everyone ends up blind. And effectively, that's what was happening with the campaign of violence, particularly the campaign of violence led by the IRA, and indeed on the Loyalist side, the campaign of violence, which was aimed at the Catholic community. People were being killed because of their religion. And John challenged both of those positions, and he challenged them, as I say, very trenchantly. And that's why people like myself, I suppose, rallied to the party that he had recently founded with the other leaders whose names I have mentioned.
Mm. Yeah. So when we made the documentary Guardians of the Flame 2 years ago now, we went to Clonard Monastery, which I don't know who's coined the phrase, but has referred to it as the cradle of the peace talks, because in a sense that Parlour 7, I think it was, or Parlour, which was on the door is 007, which they always thought was funny there at the monastery. at Clonard Monastery that we went into the room where initially John Hume and Jerry Adams, who were both from the same kind of, were Catholics, in one sense from the same community, but from very different political parties. Jerry Adams had been in favor of a violent struggle. John Hume had been an advocate for a peaceful compromise. And then after their initial meetings, you then were part of a delegation of the SDLP that joined him to have conversations with a delegation from Sinn Féin. And that was in Clonard, was it? Or
In Clonard, but also in St. Gerard's on the Antrim Road, which was another location where the same order of priests were located.
Okay.
And those series of talks were aimed at creating, as far as Sinn Féin was concerned, aimed at creating a kind of pan-nationalist front where the parties, the two main parties from the nationalist tradition in Northern Ireland, would work together on a set of particular objectives. Now, we in the SDLP strongly opposed that for as long as Sinn Féin supported the campaign of violence. We said we couldn't be party in any way to a project which involved a party that was supporting the so-called arms struggle of the IRA. I suppose the benefit of those meetings was that it enabled a dialogue to open up and develop, which lasted over several more years, tragically lasted much longer than we would have hoped at the time. But it was that dialogue that led eventually to the IRA declaring its ceasefire, realizing that its campaign was not going to be successful, however long it was going to last, that it was driving a wedge between the communities rather than bringing the communities together. And I suppose in terms of resolving conflict, you do need people who support the conflict, who support the violence, who supported here the IRA. You do need some people within that movement to begin to question the validity of the violence, of the violent campaign, and to begin to feel that there must be an alternative. And we in the SDLP were presenting an alternative, but we said we could only cooperate with Sinn Féin on that alternative if Sinn Féin was to eschew the support that it had been giving hitherto to the campaign for violence.
Mm. Do you have any recollections or memories of those meetings that kind of stand out, kind of moments of deep heat or conflict, or moments where you felt like you were really making progress? And
well, in one sense, I don't suppose we had expected a great deal of immediate progress from those talks, because there was no sense that Sinn Féin was going to forgo the support that it was giving and had been giving for a long period of time to the campaign for violence. What it did impress me was that there was a sincere conviction amongst those from Sinn Féin whom he met to find an alternative to end the violence, because the violence was causing huge problems within their own community. I mean, the number of people from the Catholic community who are suffering the so-called retribution that the loyalist paramilitaries were visiting upon the Catholic community was putting huge pressure on Sinn Féin because of its support. And it wasn't getting anywhere. There was no sign that Britain was going to withdraw from Northern Ireland. There was no sign that there was any increase in the number of people from a unionist background who might accept or acquiesce in even a united Ireland, given the violence that was taking place and that was orchestrated by those who claimed that a united Ireland would be the best solution to our problems. So the dialogue that took place between ourselves and Sinn Féin was the beginning, as I've said previously, it was the beginning of the peace process, as it subsequently became known. And that led eventually to the ceasefire in 1994. So hopefully, you know, when the history books get written, that that series of meetings and the dialogue that continued between John and John Hume and Gerry Adams will be seen to have been hugely significant.
Mm. Maybe just one more question about John Hume and even perhaps even Gerry Adams. It strikes me that in today's world, if you imagine during a civil conflict, two political leaders who had large support from their own communities come together to meet, I can only imagine egos and puffed out chests and intransigence. But somehow, as you're saying, those talks did lead the way to a peace deal that we now have, a utterly transformed country, really, because of their conversations. What does it say about the character of John Hume? What does it say even about Gerry Adams? Was there somehow a humility created between them? What was it about their conversations that allowed them to move beyond just kind of, the usual posturing and egos?
I suppose, in one sense, it's not an easy question to answer, because my sense about both men is that they were not egotistical in their approach to the dialogue that took place and that they essentially orchestrated. I think John, from his own background and from his own convictions, believed that he was engaged in an essential dialogue. There had to be somebody in Sinn Féin who was at least asking questions about the validity of the IRA campaign. And that happened to be Gerry Adams and those around him, who agreed that they had to question the validity of the campaign after, 15, 16 years of a futile campaign. And they met a man in John Hume who was utterly convinced of the simple message that it's only through partnership that we're going to resolve the kind of conflict and the differences between our communities and turn the relationship between those communities into a positive one rather than the negative one that it had been for decades and decades before then. So there was a certain humility in John's approach, because it's the age-old approach of essentially, if you like, love your neighbour rather than attack and kill your neighbour, that John was propagating.
Mm. That's brilliant. Maybe a broader question about Northern Ireland and indeed maybe many countries with this conflict. I was interviewing earlier today a friend who had been a journalist in the former Yugoslavia and during the times of the Balkan Wars in Bosnia and in Kosovo as well. He was reflecting on the fact that things like the Hague war crime tribunals, while necessary in a sense, and while the victims of, say, Srebrenica may feel, happy that someone has been brought to justice, so to speak, he was making the point that he didn't feel that had really changed mindsets in places like Serbia or the Serbian population in Bosnia about what happened. It's not like they've all gone, oh, right, maybe we were in the wrong. we should do something to fix it. There, you know, Milosevic or whoever been found guilty has just almost entrenched this sense that they are victims or, you know. Anyway, the bigger picture, it was Bruce Clark was saying it, the bigger picture was he was questioning, he wasn't saying it's wrong to have war crime tribunals, but how do we remember well? Like, how do we deal with the past is, I suppose, the essential question. And how do we deal with it in such a way that it brings, contributes towards healing and reconciliation? And of course, you know, so I'd be interested to hear your take on the past. What do we do with the past, with remembering in a way that could be constructive and lead towards peacemaking?
I think you've asked a question with a question that many of us are grappling with here, and I don't think that we've really come up with clear answers to the question. It's highly unlikely that people who were responsible for conducting paramilitary campaigns here are going to come out and put their hands up and say that we were wrong. Mm. Maybe there can be some kind of truth-telling process in which people might be encouraged and might even be attracted to taking part in, but it would have to be voluntary. There's a great deal of community relations work being undertaken right across Northern Ireland and indeed between North and South, particularly in border areas. And a lot of that work has been hugely beneficial in a sense, helping us to implement the Good Friday Agreement and the aims and objectives that the Good Friday Agreement set us. But it's very difficult to actually measure the extent to which we have really implemented that agreement in the most effective ways that we would like to see it implemented. Observing community relations work, let's say in a place like Coromila, which, you know, pre-existed the Troubles and continued doing fantastic work throughout the Troubles in terms of helping to bring some people together. There's still a need for Coromila 50, 60 years after it was established. And the work that it continues to do is absolutely essential. But how effective we're going to be in the short term, maybe it's going to take, you know, several decades and generations before we can really feel that we have achieved what the people who set up organizations like Coromila hoped to achieve. It's an ongoing process, and I don't think there's any finality to it. Even in the best governed societies, there's still going to be a need for people to work at developing community relationships, because as we see, the extent to which racism, for example, is to be seen and experienced in countries with well-run governmental and other public institutions. You know, it's a challenge to develop community relations. It's a challenge in every society. And, you know, if I'm not answering your question in any precise way, it's because I think it is a bit of a messy business working at community relationships, because you're dealing with people's age-old antagonisms, stereotypes, and so on. That it's very difficult, I think, to measure the success. The fact that we have a peaceful society here is something now that we're very grateful for. But nonetheless, when you peel back the layers in our society, you can see that there are still residues of the old antagonisms, and we've got to work very hard at trying to remove these.
Another member of the SDLP that obviously was hugely influential and became the very first Deputy First Minister in the new Northern Ireland Assembly was Seamus Mellon. And we interviewed him again for our documentary. One of the points he made, we said, I think the question was something like, what do you think of the ingredients of a peaceful society? And he made the point where a peaceful society should be where all sides can call it home. He was, of course, in Market Hill, which is quite a unionist / loyalist town. But that he wanted to be able to say he can call this home. His red, white, and blue neighbor can call it home. What do you think about Northern Ireland in terms of the future? Do you see hope, like we're getting somewhere? There's hope on the horizon?
Oh, yeah. Well, hope will never die, I think, in the human heart. And Seamus's concept, a shared home place, which is the title of his biography, you know, neatly encapsulates what we have to keep aiming at. And that is that it is a real shared home place where we're all comfortable with each other, no matter what our backgrounds. And I think that's going to remain forever the objective in a society like ours coming out of conflict. I mean, it's over 20 years since, you know, we saw the end of conflict and the Good Friday Agreement. And the Good Friday Agreement contains, as I said earlier, contains the challenge to create that shared home place that Seamus talks about so eloquently in his book.
Yeah. So just kind of coming to we'll begin to wrap up our conversation. I remember reading in Nelson Mandela's autobiography, The Long Walk to Freedom, he talked about how the struggle, the anti-apartheid struggle, had forged real character in a lot of the leaders. There was almost like a reason why so many strong leaders emerged in the movement there. And if I look back on Northern Ireland during the Troubles, it did produce people like John Hume and Seamus Mellon that you've referred to. Do you think that's true? Did it kind of forge something in them to become better? And what then is a hope for a new generation that, you know, do we have the same kind of statesmen emerging who can really carry on the baton?
Time will tell. And I suppose the evidence in the telling will be the extent to which, you know, we have achieved the shared home place that Seamus talked about. I think in many respects, yes, the hope for Northern Ireland is a realistic hope. I don't think it's a fairy tale or a dream. I think it's possible. I mean, compared with many other societies that have overcome conflict, you know, while there are still a long way to go in Northern Ireland, there's a lot of positive achievements. And I think the positive achievements can be attributed to the general good sense of people here. I often think that if there was to be an award made, one could make an award to the people of Northern Ireland for having withstood the violence that we experienced. Because when you think about it, life went on more or less as intended for most people here. We lived, as I often think, we lived ordinary lives in extraordinary times here. I mean, when you think about it, the buses ran, the trains ran, the hospitals functioned, the schools functioned, the universities functioned, and workplaces operated. But of course, that it was in a context of violence. But the amazing thing is that we did not experience the terrible tragedies of the Balkans. We didn't go over the cliff. And that has to be attributed to the fact that there was a sense of decency here, which prevented us in many ways from going over the cliff. To what do you attribute that? It's difficult to know precisely what you can attribute it. But it is quite, I think, surprising to many people who look at the violence in Northern Ireland and, of course, think about it as, you know, what enveloped everybody's daily life. But it didn't, and the people didn't allow it to, notwithstanding the terrible things that did happen. That gives me hope that the future is brighter. And, you know, maybe we need to work on convincing ourselves that the future is much brighter than sometimes people think.
And finally, you've become the chair of this new John Hume Foundation. Can you just share with us any thoughts about what that could lead to and what the plans are for that?
Well, the John and Pat Hume Foundation, it's named after both John and his wife, Pat, came out of discussions that a number of former colleagues and friends of John been having over 2 or 3 years prior to our launch. And the general view and the challenge that we had put to ourselves was, how do you ensure that John and Pat's legacy is not only commemorated, which would mean looking at the past and reminding people of what they did, but also trying to sustain that legacy in terms of what it meant, in terms of the values that the legacy contains, in terms of the aims and objectives in building a society together. To quote John's very frequent phrase, spilling our sweat and not our blood. So it was to try and ensure that his basic messages would be sustained and indeed developed for future generations. Those were the motives, if you like, for establishing the foundation. And the foundation, which was launched in public a few weeks ago, will organize on its own and indeed very often in conjunction with and partnership with other similarly minded organizations, seminars, workshops, conferences, dialogue around the values and around the aims and objectives and the methodologies that the Humes used in order to promote the peaceful resolution to conflict.
Well, that's it's just very, I find that very inspiring, because I think I often reflect on people like John Hume and think, we need more people like that, you know, and the idea that a foundation could be set up that with a real intense desire to foster that in a new generation seems, you know, very hopeful. It's kind of exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, one of the essential focal points for the foundation will be the development of leadership skills, and doing so in the context of the philosophy that John espoused himself. I mean, another of John's frequently stated phrases was respect for difference. None of us is responsible for the family into which we're born. None of us is responsible for the culture into which we are brought up. And the difference between us in one culture and somebody in another culture, the difference there should be a matter to celebrate, not a matter for division. And unfortunately, what we have done here in Northern Ireland is promote difference to the point of conflict. Difference should be something that we are delighted with, happy with, and indeed celebrate the best aspects of it. And we have a great deal that we could celebrate here in Northern Ireland, indeed in Ireland generally. And that's what we want to promote. And it's leadership towards that the foundation will focus on.
That's I think that is a real good way to kind of bring our conversation to an end. I think to say that we should celebrate difference, if that was said, you know, in a cafe in Paris or something, or maybe, I don't know, some nice, comfortable place, it would be a nice statement. But I think when it comes from someone like yourself, who's lived and worked in this island and particularly in this northern part for many years, it becomes, that's a very powerful statement, I think. And it's a statement that carries weight with it, you know, that difference is something we should celebrate and not be something that should tear us apart. And I really hope that even this conversation in a small way kind of just helps to, again, lead us, many, whoever is listening to this, wherever they are, to kind of consider ways in which difference has been something that has maybe been something that they've used to kind of create or to acknowledge dividing walls and to hide behind them. But your words, and, you know, kind of really quoting John Hume about celebrating difference, is seems so resonant to us today. So
thank you.
So Sean Farron, thank you so much for your time with us. And this has been a really good conversation. Thank you so much. Thank you.